Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Gail Seiler, together with Kay Puttick. Hello, Kay. Thanks for co-hosting today.
It's great to be here. We want to let our listeners know that KHOI's fundraising drive starts this Friday and runs for 10 days. We'll be asking listeners to become members and support KHOI, which is a not-for-profit, commercial-free, local radio station serving Central Iowa.
And we've got all kinds of fun and interesting things planned. We were talking about it the other day and saying it's really going to be a fun drive as well as a fund drive. So listeners should stay tuned. And today we have a show packed full of interesting stories. So let's get started, Kay.
We'll be hearing from a community organization, MICA, or Mid-Iowa Community Action. And we'll have two guests in the studio to tell us about the time capsule put together to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the City of Ames.
But first, we're going to have an interview with Rachel Williams. Rachel Williams is an associate professor in gender, women's, and sexuality studies at the University of Iowa. And since 1993, she's been working with incarcerated women at correctional facilities in Florida, Wisconsin, Montana, and Iowa. She was in Ames recently and spoke at ISU as part of their lecture series. Her talk was called Prison Chronicles, Working with Incarcerated Women. Earlier that day, I sat down with her and we spoke about her work, and we are going to hear excerpts from that conversation now. I began by asking what she sees as the main issues related to prisons and incarceration here in Iowa.
Well, I think one of the things that's really important to know about Iowa is there's definitely a disproportionate number of people of color who are incarcerated in the state compared to the ratio of minority populations in the state. I think the other thing that's important to think about is we are currently in a state where, you know, the mental health institutions are closing. The former juvenile home for girls has been closed. They are building, you know, prisons are expanding here in spite of the fact that there's been a decline in crime. You know, the other thing that's really important is we're a state that could offer a lot of options in terms of community corrections. On the other hand, I would say that I've seen a number of prisons across the country, and especially in terms of women's prisons, I think the correctional institution here is pretty interesting. And, you know, in some ways, it's really provides a unique model for care and education and for rehabilitation, which I think is really fascinating. And, you know, it makes it a very exciting place to work in terms of what's happening. You know, and I always say to people, it's not necessarily the Department of Corrections that's the problem. You know, you really have to look a little bit deeper at how the laws are structured. That's one thing that I think is really important. The other thing I think is important is that as a person who works at an institution of higher education, I think we have a tremendous number of resources. And, you know, those aren't necessarily monetary resources. But I think, you know, the faculty and staff at institutions of higher education have just a wealth of knowledge. They also tend to have the ability to, you know, interact with other people while they're working as part of their job. And then we also have amazing students who are really eager to learn, you know, about life in all kinds of settings and figure out how what they're studying, you know, how that plays a role in real life and in real culture. And so I feel like those are pretty amazing resources that we have. And I think a lot of times, you know, people who end up involved with the criminal justice system have not had a very good educational experience, you know, as a younger person. And so, and there have been studies for sure that say people who are given chances to experience education in all kinds of ways, it doesn't have to necessarily be credit-bearing or formal, it can be very informal educational experiences, do tend to do better and do tend to recidivate at lower rates. You know, it's really a chance for them to think about other ways to construct an identity. So I think that's also very important. One of the things that I really was really impressed with recently that the Department of Corrections is doing is so many people, when they get out of prison, they oftentimes, in prison for the first time, sometimes they actually receive mental health care. You know, and you can talk about if that's standard or substandard mental health care. But so oftentimes if they have an addiction, they may have been self-medicating in order to sort of deal with being bipolar or depressed or, you know, what other issues might have come across their plate. But so oftentimes they find a medication that will help them sort of stabilize a little bit. But then when they get out of prison, many prisons say, here's 30 days worth of meds, good luck. So, and there's a certain amount of lag time between, you know, getting some sort of insurance help or getting some sort of Medicaid or Medicare help and continuing to see a therapist and then, or a doctor even, and staying on that medication. And so, you know, for example, if you're on a serotonin-based medication and you try to just go off that cold turkey, it can be very, very difficult and it can really destabilize a person. And so the Iowa Department of Corrections now has a program where they give you 90 days of med to kind of, you know, cover that donut hole where you get out of prison and where you actually are interacting with public health people. The other thing I think the Iowa Department of Corrections is doing, which I think is really important, is there was a time when your medical record in prison did not follow you out of prison. And so, you know, you would basically have to start over in terms of your history with any kind of healthcare professional that you saw. And so the Iowa Department of Corrections is really working to change that so that people can have continuity of care, you know, throughout their entire experience. And I think right now when our mental health care safety nets are being torn apart and falling apart, you know, it's these kinds of things that could make a huge difference in terms of whether we grow our correctional population or shrink it.
I wanted to know more about the work she does with incarcerated women in Mitchellville Prison in Iowa specifically, which is the only women's prison in the state. So I asked Rachel Williams about how this work got started and how it has grown to meet the needs of the women at the prison and also to provide learning opportunities for students at the University of Iowa.
I began as an artist working and teaching art, you know, which I had no idea that that would be allowed. And it was a great experience. I started teaching art in Florida, and since then I've taught in London, I've taught in, you know, down in Keys, I've been in Montana in jail. So I've taught all over the place. And I've almost always worked exclusively with women. I have worked with men, and I've never had a bad experience working with men. I've found that they're just as, you know, open and kind and gentle as any women I've ever worked with. But my passion, you know, and my calling really is to work with women. Mitchellville is where I work primarily now, ICIW. So there was this one summer, and that's the only way I can sort of explain this transition, where in that summer I trained to be a rape victim advocate for RVAP in Iowa City, and then I also trained through the Domestic Violence Intervention Program to work with people who had experienced domestic violence. And I also went to the Inside Out prison training program because up until that point, I had never had students come in with me. And that year, I had begun to bring in students. So that summer, all of those things happened, and then the Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies Department caught wind that I had brought students in and volunteers in. And I had a creative writing program going at that point with the Iowa Women's Arc. And so they said, would you consider teaching our practicum class and bringing our students with you? And I thought, this is a dream. Went to the women at the prison, you know, in my art class and said, what would that look like? What do you think would be most useful? So, you know, what can we do? And the women said, you know, we have some real things going on. And so we spent a year, my students and a fabulous core group of women at the prison, and we put together a think tank. And in that year, you know, we did a lot of work together to sort of figure out what are some really pertinent issues. And the women brought to the surface, and I mean the women on the inside and on the outside, and said, they said, motherhood is a big deal here. We need to figure out ways to connect with our children or to stay connected with our children. Just staying connected is really difficult. Birth is important here. Substance abuse is a huge problem. And then relationships. You know, they said this is another thing that's really a problem. And then also medical care. And so at the end of that year, we decided, you know, we need to share what we've learned with all the women who are at this prison. And so the administration was really open and really supportive. And they said, we'll just have an all-day conference for anyone who wants to come on prison grounds. They can come to this conference. And so I brought in panels of experts from the outside. The women who had been in the think tank were also on the panels. And then my students were also on the panels. And it was incredibly popular. And out of that, Nicole Nisley was one of the experts that I brought. She's a physician. And she said, you know, they have one doctor here and a very small handful of nurses to take care of, you know, 400 to 600 women that often have never had medical tension, you know, and have some pretty chronic disabilities in terms of everything from diabetes and high blood pressure to bipolar, schizophrenia. We've been trying to build bridges with the College of Medicine and with dentistry and pharmacy to have students come out there and provide services. The motherhood piece, the program, Mitchellville actually has a number of really good programs for mothers. They have mother support group, they have story time, they have a lot of things. But they didn't have pre- and postnatal birth education opportunities. So we've been trying to build those things. Substance abuse is something that is out beyond the scope of my practice. And so, you know, I wish we could have more groups come in and work with people there. But they said, you know, relationships are a really big deal. And the warden said, you know, women in here have relationships with each other, and they run the spectrum from intimate to friendships. And there's always, you know, because the prison is such an intense place, oftentimes things happen, you know, that can be physically violent. And this is a cause of a lot of angst and a lot of disciplinary problems that we have. And so she said, would you do a healthy relationships class? And I said, great. So then we all worked together, including the women at the prison, to create this curriculum. You know, so we would come up with ideas. The women would, we'd teach, you know, and see how that went. I think we're in our fifth year now of running that program. And so we talk about domestic violence, sexual assault, codependent relationships, communication, boundaries, you know, red flags and abusive relationships, identity, you know, what's your identity? And then we cross that with intersectionality. So then we also talk about cultural and social forces, so race, you know, class, gender, and oppression and how those things work. So I feel like it's been really successful. So that's one thing I do. So in the fall, I had 15 students from Iowa and 6 groups of women at the prison. So I think we served 105 women this fall through that experience. And then I also work with female sex offenders. And Mitchellville, as far as we know, is the only prison that we've been able to find in the United States that has created a curriculum specifically for women and that's group oriented. So most of the time you do one-on-one therapy with those women. And so that's pretty interesting and pretty exciting. And I also work as a pre- and postnatal doula for the DOC. And we just started that. So I meet with women who are getting ready to have babies, and then I try to find them at Mitchellville after they've had children and just check in and say, how did it go? How are you doing? So those are the things I do right now.
This is Local Talk on KHOI. We're listening to an interview with Rachel Williams, a professor in gender, women's, and sexuality studies at the University of Iowa. She was recently in Ames to speak about her work with women who are incarcerated. Dr. Williams explained that the courses she provides in the prison are non-credit. However, they are greatly valued by the women themselves, and participation in the courses is often recognized positively by the parole board when making parole decisions. I was struck by how the curriculum and ideas for the groups came from the women themselves, and Dr. Williams explained her thinking on that.
Well, I mean, I really do strongly believe that everybody has the potential to solve their own problems. I mean, you can't give people advice. You can't say this is what you should do because you really have no idea. And so I think if you can offer them some questions, you know, and let them make all the choices in terms of what it is they look at, they take in, they research, they use. So we provide a lot of tools. You know, we say, here are some different tools you can try. Developing curricula is a really dynamic process. And so what works, you know, one semester falls very flat the next semester. Or, you know, you also realize you have an idea of what you think people might not know, and then you realize they actually know it far better than you do. So, you know, the tables are turned and they're suddenly saying, well, if you're going to teach this again, you might think about this, that, and the other. And so that's, you know, that's always really humbling and really wonderful. Every week I try to give them something to read on their own. And they share things. I mean, this is the other thing I love about this program. So things circulate. So if I give them a copy of something and they really like it, they'll share it with, you know, everyone that's in their unit. But they also do some great writing and they read aloud what they've written. So I think that's, you know, really important. And it's a great way to develop a social imagination and to imagine scenarios that you haven't actually experienced.
I also asked her about the impact of this work on her and on the university students.
I mean, I think for me, writing is really the way I deal with some of this stuff because there's a lot of cognitive dissonance that happens, you know, and there's a lot of tension and there's a lot of, you hear a lot of stories, you know, and it's a lot to take in and sort of have wash over you. And then sometimes you really do feel powerless to, you know, you can't, like I said, you really can't help someone. You know, they have to help themselves and they have to make those decisions. And so it's hard to see, you know, women struggling with things. And for my students, so we, you know, whatever the women in the circle do, my students do as well, because it's got to be even all the way around. And so they have to be willing to be vulnerable and share. And I really believe you can't ask your students to do something that you're not willing to do with them. I think that's incredibly important. So, you know, we have some pretty heavy journal prompts where we ask women to write about particular ideas, and my students do that, and many of them say, you know, I'd never thought about these things before. And actually having the experience of all of the women in the room is fascinating. I always start with my students and I say, well, what are your stereotypes about women in prison? And they have some very strong stereotypes. And then I say to them, what do you think the women in prison think you're like as a college student? And they're surprised. So it's a unique moment when they're like, oh, people are thinking about who we are as well. And the writing that comes out of this program is phenomenal. I mean, I always, at the end, we have sort of a graduation ceremony and people share different things. And we incorporate a lot of creative writing and reading in our program, and I think poetry is just an incredibly powerful tool. And I mean, some of the things the women have written will just knock your socks off. Just really powerful work. So I think it's great for my college students to see that, you know, even though you're not in college, you may be an intellectual heavyweight. And so don't judge people. Be aware of what your judgments are.
We also discussed the support these programs have received from the prison administration and challenges faced by the women when they are released from prison.
I've been able to work at ICIW for 14 years because the administrative staff there, it's very, all the wardens have been women, you know, during the time I've been there. And the associate director for treatment is a man, but he's incredible. You know, he has the heart of a social worker. And they're very supportive, and they really do, you know, want these women to have an experience where they, you know, can really focus on themselves and figure out what can I do to have a different kind of life when I leave this place. If you talk to someone who's been in prison and they're in a work release facility, for example, they will fill out literally hundreds of job applications just trying to get a job anywhere, doing anything. I mean, anything. Fast food, brick walls, I mean, anything they can do. And so it's really hard to get a job. And then it's hard to have a job that has a living wage, especially if you have family. And with women, what's really hard is most of those women were the primary caregivers of their children. And so not only is their life deeply affected by prison, their children's lives are too. And so, you know, that in and of itself is very tragic and very difficult.
One of the last things I asked her was if she ever followed up with the women after they left prison. And here's what she said.
You know, I do sometimes. I'm not supposed to because I'm a volunteer, but it's, you know, I've had women that I've known for years and years and years. So I end up running into them or they'll get in touch with me and say, you know, I just wanted you to know I'm doing this now. And oftentimes it's a great story. You know, it's a story that I'm really tickled to hear. They'll send me pictures of their kids. And so I think that's always really encouraging. What's not encouraging is when they come back and I see them in the prison again and I just want to say, why are you here? You know, what are you doing? I don't want to see you here. And so that's pretty heartbreaking. And it's not uncommon, but it's also not uncommon for them to get out. And it's hard. It's really hard to make a life after you've been in prison. I mean, you are sentenced to a civil death, especially if you're a felon. And it's hard to pick up the pieces after something like that.
Finally, I asked Rachel Williams what people can do if someone is concerned about issues related to incarceration, particularly of women, and concerned about the far-reaching effects, for example, on children of women in prison. What can they do?
First thing I would do is I would write to your state representatives, you know, and let them know that you're concerned about these things. I would also vote. I think voting is incredibly powerful. And I think write to the governor, you know, and say there's some things that we could change. I mean, for me, the two things that are really important in terms of our social fabric are violence against women and then also mental health care. You know, those are two really, really important things. And so I think it's unethical to criminalize people that have mental health problems. And substance abuse, in my mind, is connected to mental health issues. And I think violence against women, I mean, for example, the organization that I work for in Iowa City, we used to cover, I think it was 5 counties, and now because of the way funding has changed, we now cover 14 counties. You know, shelters have closed across the state. Mm-hmm. So I think that there really is a war against women, and I think violence against women is one of the key, you know, parts of women ending up in prison.
That was Professor Rachel Williams telling us about the work she and her students from the University of Iowa do with women who are incarcerated at Mitchellville, the women's prison in Iowa. We want to thank her for sitting down and talking with me about this work when she was at ISU recently. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa.
Next, we're switching gears a little, but still focusing on supporting the needs of women and children. Each month, we highlight a different community service organization, and this month we're highlighting a group called Mid-Iowa Community Action, or MICA, which is a nonprofit organization serving children and families in central Iowa. My guest today is Sierra Stevens from MICA, which is Mid-Iowa Community Action, and she's come to talk about the child care program, WIC,
yep.
Women, Infants, and Children, mm-hmm. and also Maternal and Child Health.
Yep.
Would you tell us a bit about yourself first and how you became involved with MICA and so on?
Yeah, I actually have a degree in dietetics from Iowa State University, and my job requires a degree in dietetics. I completed my dietetic internship through the Iowa State University as well, and then I interned with MICA at the WIC program for about 2 weeks, and that's how I ended up getting a job there. I started out just as a travel dietitian. We cover an 8-county area, mm-hmm. so I worked mainly out of our Marshalltown office and traveled a bit, and then a few months down the road, I got the lead dietitian job in our Ames office and eventually moved up to WIC coordinator, and I've been here for about 2 years.
Okay. The role with which you started, at least, was advising mothers, parents about child nutrition?
Correct. Yep. I just served families at the most basic level, educating them on how to feed themselves if they're pregnant, any breastfeeding concerns, how to feed children and infants, and then set up their food packages, made sure they knew how to use their WIC checks.
Okay. Well, could you explain all those things, like WIC checks?
Yes. So WIC is a special supplemental program. We serve women, infants, and children. And throughout the process, they receive nutrition education from a dietitian, health care information and development screens from a nurse. And at the end of the appointment, they get some checks for nutritious foods. So based on their participant type, if they're a woman who's breastfeeding or if they're a woman who's formula feeding, if it's a child, they get very specific foods such as milk, eggs, peanut butter, a whole grain option, those kinds of things.
Okay. Now, what kind of people are eligible for this program?
Anybody who is at 185% of the federal poverty level would qualify. We just ask to see pay stubs from the last 30 days to determine that mm-hmm. at their initial certification appointment. However, if families have Medicaid or food stamps, they automatically qualify for WIC regardless of their income.
Now, you mentioned nurses examining the pregnant women. I know that in the past it was difficult for women who were on Medicaid to get their prenatal appointments. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, we don't do a lot of the stuff that the OB doctors do at our appointments. We screen for anemia, which is pretty common during pregnancy. We also just make sure that they have a doctor or able to find a doctor. And if they don't have a doctor because of insurance reasons, they don't know who to see, we can refer them to a doctor and just follow up with them.
And is it easy to find doctors locally?
Now, I think more so than others, we have the new primary health center that will see women, and there's some OBs in town. And so for most women, I feel like it's been a very easy process to find an OB doctor during the pregnancy.
Okay, good. Aside from caring for infants and children, what else do you do?
We help with any women who have breastfeeding concerns. Mm-hmm. And so we're always promoting breastfeeding in our clinic and just following up with women throughout the pregnancy to make sure they have the education they need to be successful. With WIC, we also have a breastfeeding peer counseling program, and we have 6 women who are called peer counselors. We have 3 in our Ames office and 3 in our Marshalltown office, and they just assist any women who are interested in being on their program. They can call them, text them, email them, meet them at the clinic if they want to meet in person, and they provide them any education they want, so it's very specific to what that woman specifically wants to know. They usually contact them once a month unless less frequency is mm-hmm. needed. And as they get closer to the due date, they contact them more frequently. So that way that mother is prepared to know what happens after the baby's born in terms of breastfeeding.
Right. Is breastfeeding very popular with your mothers?
I think it depends on the clinic. Here in Story County at our Ames office, we see a higher percentage of moms who are initially breastfeeding, and I think that's with the partnership with Mary Greeley and them working towards being breastfeeding friendly. Some of our other rural clinics, we see lower breastfeeding rates because it's not as promoted at hospitals.
Right.
And sometimes women just don't have that support that they need. They don't have a mother or a grandmother who breastfed to help them be successful. So a lot of women initially start off breastfeeding, but change to formula very quickly.
That's too bad. You know, it's so much easier. The right temperature.
Absolutely.
Doesn't need sterilizing.
Yes.
Wake up at night, you don't have to get up and get the bottle in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You're successful with the breastfeeding in AIM.
With the 8 counties we serve, we also have 5 of our counties that have a maternal and child health grant. And so with those, they coexist with the WIC clinics, and we're able to provide additional services that we can't at our other clinics that don't have that grant. And so, for example, here in Story County at our Ames clinic, we have the child health and maternal health grant. So when children come into clinics, they not only are getting their hemoglobin tested, which is their iron, which is part of the WIC process, but we can also do a lead screening. And we do that once a year. And that just helps families make sure that they don't have any problems with lead poisoning.
Lead poisoning.
Mm-hmm. And if they do, we can refer them back to their doctor. And we can provide nutrition education to those families whose children do have a high lead level. We can also do developmental screens for children, and so we usually do those about once a year. And we just started the ages stages questionnaire, which is a little bit longer of a development screen, but if there are any development problems, we can help them get in contact with their doctor.
Okay. Now, the lead poisoning thing, suppose you discover that a child has been eating lead paint or something.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from getting them to see a doctor and so on, do you do anything about the cause of that?
There are programs to help with that. I don't know in Story County.
Like, you know, the peeling paint or whatever.
Yes.
It is.
Yeah. There are programs that help look at the house, determine what's wrong, if it is something in the house, if it's a lead pipe, if there's lead in the paint, and they can assist families in doing that. We don't have that program in our health services department, but there is that help elsewhere.
So you link them up with that, would you?
Yeah. Yep. That's part of the program. We just help provide them referrals to whatever they need.
Okay.
We also have the maternal health program, again, in our Story County office and in 4 other counties. And if women choose to sign up for that, they just provide a little bit of extra assistance to moms. They still need to continue to go to their OB appointments. It doesn't replace that, but it just kind of provides them with a little bit of extra one-on-one time. You know, when women are in their doctor's office, they're in and out so quickly that
right.
They don't always get the chance to ask those questions that they really want. And so that's what our maternal health nurse says. She's a registered nurse, and she just talks about what's going on in that certain point of the pregnancy. Answers any questions, concerns they have. She makes sure they're gaining weight correctly, they're eating correctly. She can provide prenatal vitamins to moms and can help them get signed up for presumptive Medicaid, which is 2 months of Medicaid. Usually they try to time that sometime in the middle of the pregnancy to help pay for ultrasounds and that kind of thing.
Okay. Now, you mentioned low hemoglobin in the children.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that that was a problem with.
Yeah, especially in the low-income population where there's maybe not as much nutrition resources, and especially iron-rich foods like the animal protein, dark green leafy vegetables, those kinds of things. So sometimes children's iron can run low. Kids tend to drink a lot of milk, and so that can lower their iron over time as well. And so we just want to make sure we're screening for that and providing any tips that families need to help increase their children's iron.
Okay. So that is quite common, is it? Low iron in small children. I believe you have dental programs too.
We do, yep. For both our child and maternal health programs, we provide a dental hygienist at the clinic who specializes in public health. And she can do dental screenings, look at a child's teeth, make sure they're doing okay. She can provide a fluoride varnish, which helps prevent against cavities. And if children don't have a dental home, she can help find them one. I think the biggest problem is for kids at 1 year, they recommend seeing a dentist, and a lot of dentists won't see them. So she...
You mean because they're on Medicaid or
no,
because they're so young?
No, because just the age. A lot of dentists don't... I don't know if they see the importance, or it's just that they're so young. It's really hard to get them to sit still. There's not a lot of teeth. And so our dental hygienists really encourage families to see a dentist at 1, and they have a list of dentists in the area that will see a child at 1, even if it's not the family's dentist. The same with the maternal health program. If a woman is on that maternal health program, she will also see a dental hygienist throughout her pregnancy. Dental screenings, again, fluoride varnishes for the mother, and just assisting in finding a dental home during the pregnancy, and really encouraging to go because it's still important during pregnancy to go to the dentist.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they used to say, there's an old-fashioned saying, you lose a tooth for every pregnancy.
Yep. And a lot of our women find that they have a lot of dental problems during the pregnancy. So we just try to help them get connected to the resources to help them take care of their teeth.
Do you have any huge successes that you'd like to share?
Yeah. Every year we always have a lot of success stories, and we encourage staff to to give us success stories so that we can report those at the end of your reports and that kind of thing. One that comes to my mind, especially with breastfeeding, is, you know, so many women struggle with it immediately. And just rather than contact us, help, you know, have them help us find those resources for them, talk them through it, they just changed a formula right away. We had one mom in particular who was really struggling with breastfeeding right off the bat, had a breast pump and was just exclusively pumping, but that's not necessarily ideal. It does a little bit more work than just nursing a baby.
Sure.
So we referred her to the lactation consultants at Mary Greeley, and she had been working pretty closely with them. She also had a breastfeeding peer counselor, and she helped work it with her at the clinic with latching and any other problems that she was having. And by the time the baby was 4 months old, she was completely done with pumping. She was just nursing the baby and having a great time. And she ended up being able to nurse the baby for the full first year. And I just don't think without the resources from Mary Greeley and from our breastfeeding peer counselors, I don't think she would have been as successful. And because she was breastfeeding, she got a larger food package from WIC and was able to get that up until the child was 1 year. And it was about $70.
So that's an inducement, is it?
Yes. Yes, okay. Absolutely. We have breast pumps that women can rent out at WIC. We don't charge for them. They just come in monthly to check in with the dietitian to see mm-hmm. how things are going. And when women don't receive any formula, they get additional foods on their checks. So a lot of women really like the cheese and the fish that we can add on to there.
Oh, well, that makes sense, as you say, because they're mm-hmm. not using the formula.
Yeah.
Now, why is it, do you think, that people have so much trouble with breastfeeding? Because it, you know, it's a natural thing. Mm-hmm. And in other cultures, nobody bats an eye about it.
I think there's just such a lack of support with some women, especially with moms and grandmas. If they never breastfed, they're always a big source of support to women. And so if they can't assist them with breastfeeding, they tend not to be successful. A lot of women have really good intentions that they want to breastfeed, but they don't take the time to educate themselves throughout the pregnancy on breastfeeding. And so when things happen after the baby's born, you know, the baby wants to nurse a lot, the baby's crying a lot, they just don't understand that these things are normal because they didn't take the time to research that. And that's why I think just some women just aren't successful. And formula feeding is easier for them. You know, they can see exactly how much the baby's getting, the baby seems satisfied, and they're very much in control of that.
Now, you mentioned the baby crying a lot, so they then assume the baby's hungry and they're not getting enough milk.
Yep. A lot of times when babies cry, that they associate that with hunger. Mm-hmm. And just think, especially if it's a first-time mom, and just think that the baby's always hungry rather than are there other cues that need to be addressed rather than just hunger.
But there is the question of the mother's supply has to go up to meet the baby's demand. Mm-hmm. And so there is a little area there where the baby might be a bit hungry.
Yeah, and there definitely gets to be a vicious cycle in that, you know, a baby's crying, they're hungry, the mom perceives low milk supply, starts to get formula. And then the more formula she gives, the less the baby's nursing, the less milk the body's producing. And then eventually there is a low milk supply because she's only giving formula and the baby's not nursing and not stimulating that milk production at all.
But you do have success stories.
We do have success stories, yes. And it's always fun when we have those because it makes us feel good that we're doing our job right.
Okay. Thank you so much for telling us about WIC, Women and Infants and Children, and the maternal health that you provide at MICA. I've been talking to Sierra Stevens from MICA, who advises and helps women and children in their programs. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And next, we'll hear from Local Talk producer or reporter Susan Franzen, who responded to a call from Kelly, Iowa, and has this to tell us.
I'd like to tell our listeners about a spectacular event in our neighboring town of Kelly. B.J. Kearns, KHOI volunteer who lives in Kelly, called me yesterday afternoon to tell me that the oldest building in Kelly had collapsed. My first thought was to wonder what kind of building it was and when it was built. For that, she recommended that I call Duane Finch, the local historian. His account was personal and colorful. As Duane told the story, he was drinking coffee with his friends in Historical Hall, the former Congregational Church that now serves as the City Museum. He could verify that the buildings that had been destroyed were two of the oldest in Kelly, having been built in 1875. He has the deeds in the Historical Hall. The buildings on Main Street were first built by the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad Company, when it was building the track and starting a town. The two buildings were side by side on Main Street and were the grocery store and hardware stores. Upstairs was a large hall used as an Oddfellows Lodge in the early days. Later, Duane Finch recalls that it served as a movie theater of sorts when he was a boy. The upstairs also held doctor's offices at one time. There have been various apartments in the building and plans for more that never developed. At the time of the collapse, the buildings were uninhabited. Gary Millam, city water maintenance man, who recorded the event with photographs, gave an eyewitness account of the events. First, the back half of the roof collapsed, taking the center part of the back wall with it. The brick walls surrounding it collapsed as well. The fire department decided to mitigate the danger by calling in a track hoe to complete the demolition and push all the material to the center where it would not endanger anyone. Listeners may wonder why KHOI has singled out this event for special attention. Of course, one reason was that we had an on-the-spot reporter in B.J. Kearns. We invite any of our listeners to call us with news. An apartment building in Boone collapsed several weeks ago, and we read about it in the paper. When the old consolidated school in Luther was demolished, even more recently, we didn't hear a spontaneous concern. But our neighbor in Kelly has become familiar. We attended the pancake breakfast at Christmas time. The buildings that collapsed were in the center of the downtown Kelly, on Main Street. What will happen now? How will this hole in the center of town affect the citizens of Kelly? Because the people of the town are our neighbors, we'll be following the story. Maybe next time someone will call us from the Kelly phone booth. Next Wednesday, April 22nd, is the 45th Earth Day, and as far as I could see, the only related event in Ames on that date is an ISU lecture by Catherine Hayhoe at 7 p.m. in the Great Hall of the Memorial Union. Her title is Climate Urgency and How Farmers and Businessmen Can Take the Lead. If this sounds like an unusual title by a climate scientist, it is because Catherine Hayhoe is unusual. She is legitimately both an atmospheric scientist and a climate change evangelist. That means she is an evangelical Christian who also happens to be trained as a climate scientist. Her story is something that we'll probably be playing a little bit of on our Wednesday Earth Day program on Local Talk.
Thanks to Susan Franzen, one of our Local Talk producers, for putting that together for us. And now we've been joined in the studio by Casey Vance, the Executive Director of the Ames Historical Society, and Susan Guayasda, the Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames. Welcome to both of you, and thanks for being here.
Our listeners may already know that the City of Ames is celebrating its sesquicentennial this year. The city is 150 years old, and one of the things we've heard about is the time capsule that's been assembled to commemorate the city's anniversary. So let's start by explaining just what is a time capsule.
Well, first, Gail, let's just explain. We finished celebrating the sesquicentennial. It was in 2014. So now we are celebrating with some of the legacy projects, which include the history trailer, and the time capsule would be considered one of those legacy projects. Casey, why don't you talk a little bit about our process for getting the time capsule together?
Well, we decided to do several legacy projects, as Susan mentioned. And one of those, it just seemed really obvious to do a time capsule during our 150th anniversary. So the time capsule will be opened at the Bicentennial in 2076. And the Ames 150 committee, kind of a subset of that, took suggestions from the community and decided what would go in there.
For our listener, can you describe what the actual object is?
It's sort of a plastic container that is specific to be a time capsule. So it's waterproof. You could bury it. We're not going to bury it just because groundwater and all that. It's not really recommended to bury it anymore. But it is technically waterproof.
And it's not very large. That was one of the surprises to me. Having never seen a time capsule before, I didn't know what they would look like. And you're kind of limited. You can't put really huge things in them. So you have to be very cognizant of the space limitations. But also because so many people wanted to put technology in the time capsule, we had to really think about the technology limitations as the decades pass. Is a VHS tape or a cassette tape or even a floppy disk something that's going to have any relevance when this is open down the road?
Or people would even be able to listen to or access the information on. You mentioned there was a process. People could suggest things. Tell us about that.
Well, we just really opened it up to the public, and on the Ames 150 Facebook page, the Ames Historical Society Facebook page, and other places, and just compiled all the suggestions that people gave us and then sat down and thought about what things would make sense to put in there.
Yeah, people brought stuff in and wanted it to be considered. At one of our events, there was just a table full of stuff that people had said, how about this, how about this? It was really kind of difficult to piece through it all and, one, decide what would fit and what would be relevant and what would really show what life was like in 2014 in Ames, Iowa. It was a hard decision to whittle stuff down. I mean, stuff that didn't fit because of space, that was easy. But the rest of the stuff, it was pretty tricky.
So the idea behind the time capsule is to kind of capture what life is like at this moment so that when people open it in the future, they have a taste backwards of what life was like.
And we really used that as our guidelines when we were choosing items. We picked things that are really indicative of life in Ames in 2014, so we tried to just stick with the year 2014.
Where are you going to put it?
It'll be stored at the Ames Public Library in the Heritage Room.
So tell us what's in it.
Well, we, like I said, we really focused on 2014. So we have community calendars and brochures from different community groups from last year. Also programs from events that happened in 2014, especially ones that had to do with the sesquicentennial. A lot of community organizations focused their events with the sesquicentennial theme last year. So we have programs from those. We have the Ames Tribune from December 17th. And grocery ads from the week of December 17th, which is when Ames was platted, actually, on December 17th, 1864. So that was the actual 150th anniversary. So that's the significance of that date. Postage stamps from last year. Photos of Ames as it was last year. So current Ames stuff. Items from Visha last year, a brochure and a map. We have a book with photos of all of the Cyclone City statues, since that kind of tied in with the sesquicentennial also.
Sure.
So that's some of the items.
So you decided not to include technology. Those are all more or less paper artifacts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody had suggested an iPhone or an iPad, and we just thought it just maybe wouldn't be able to charge it. You wouldn't know what to do with it when you opened it. So we thought that there are probably other ways to monitor and to have those recollections and memories. But these paper things, when you open a time capsule, to actually touch the things or see what's in there, I don't know if you're supposed to touch them.
You can touch them.
There's just something about touching something that was existing in the city so many years ago. It's really an interesting experience. And these paper copies we knew would weather the years and would be able to bring back memories for those people.
And you mentioned that people could bring things to suggest that they be included. So what was the process to decide?
Well, I think it was kind of to decide. It was open to everybody, and then it became more or less space and relevance. And I think we left that to the experts at the Historical Society because that's sort of their job, is sort of documenting the history of the past. I don't know if you had a smaller group that decided or...
A couple people from the Ames 150 committee kind of sat down and went through the list initially. And then the staff at the Ames Historical Society kind of went through and made sure that those things would be relevant in 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And right now people can see the time capsule at the Ames Historical Society. Is that right?
Yep. Until the end of this month, it's on exhibit at the Historical Society. And then it'll go over to the library early next month.
Now, when you say they can see it, do you mean everything that's going to go in it as well?
Just the outside of the time capsule.
Yep. So it's already packed and sealed.
Yep.
And will it be on view in the library or just kind of packed away?
You can see it. It'll kind of be tucked away in a corner of the Heritage Room on the second floor of the library. But you could go over there and look at it.
And there have been previous time capsules in Ames, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about those, or could you tell us about those?
Well, one of the more famous ones was buried in the cornerstone of the previous City Hall, which is now the Youth and Shelter Services building. And when Youth and Shelter Services acquired that building and started doing renovations, they took the time capsule out. And I believe that was in the 90s when they opened it. So, and that was placed in 1914.
Do you know anything about what was in that?
It was also mostly paper items. Uh-huh. We have them in the archives at the Historical Society. A lot of them were discolored because of, again, it, you know, a cornerstone isn't the best place for paper items to be stored for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of photos, great photos of the early 1900s in Ames, Main Street, and all of that, and some other documents and paper items.
And I guess then they probably didn't have as well-designed a container to protect it, especially when it's outside, as you have now.
I think it was in a metal box.
So anything else the listener should know about the time capsule? And they can look forward to 50 years from now.
Yep, that's right.
The event itself, the whole sesquicentennial, was very successful. And we were recognized recently by the State of Iowa's Historical Society for the community involvement in the celebration. So Casey was able to go down and with a small group and accept the certificate of recognition from the governor recently.
Congratulations. That's wonderful. Yeah, I'm a newcomer to Ames, so I wasn't here during most of the celebration, but congratulations. Sounds like it was an exciting time.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You also have a new exhibit opening up at the Ames Historical Society on parks?
Yes, it just opened last week. It's called People of Our Parks. It focuses on 16 of Ames parks that are named after Ames residents, and it'll be up until the end of September.
Is that all the parks in Ames?
It's not.
Okay.
We don't have a whole lot of space over at the Historical Society, so we really wanted to do a really focused exhibit. And so we decided to focus on just parks that were named after Ames residents. So it doesn't include Brookside. It doesn't include Banshell. So some of those really iconic Ames parks are missing. But, yeah, it focuses on, you know, Ada Hayden, Ines Grove, Emma McCarthy Lee, all of those ones that are named after important Ames residents and kind of pulls in the history of the resident that it was named after and focuses on the significance of both the park and the resident.
Does the exhibit consist of photos and other artifacts?
Yes, it has a lot of information and great photos and a few artifacts, yep.
And are the parks in Ames, the upkeep and formation of the parks, is that something the city is responsible for?
Yeah, absolutely. We have more than 37 parks. Our newest park is Northridge Heights Park. As Casey mentioned, some of our parks are sort of named by location, like North River Valley and South River Valley, so there really isn't somebody to recognize. But as part of the growth of Ames, when new neighborhoods come in for development, that's always part of the process, is to look at green space and access to green space. And we have categories of parks such as pocket parks, neighborhood parks, and community parks, and those all mean something different as to who they're supposed to serve. And all the maintenance and upkeep of the parks is from our Parks and Recreation Department. And I have to say, I think they just do a wonderful, wonderful job. We have beautiful parks and names.
I agree, and I love the trails that connect many of them as well. So they're not just isolated entities. A lot of them seem to be interconnected. And the trails, that's part of the Parks Department as well?
Yep. The Parks and Recreation Department is responsible for the trail maintenance. Sometimes they receive assistance from the Public Works Department, but we see those trails as community connectivity and also transportation routes. So we do our best to keep those clear in the winter. We can't always get to all of them right away, but we understand that people use those to get to work and to get to school. And so there is a master plan looking at the overall community and how to connect trails together as transportation routes.
Hmm. What's the difference between a pocket park, a neighborhood park, and a community park?
It's typically size.
Okay.
Tom Evans, Cynthia Duff here on Main Street, those are smaller pocket parks. So by size, they're not particularly large.
Little
walkthrough
right,
that used to be actually a building.
I love that name.
Yeah.
A pocket park.
Sort of just wherever you can stick it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then like community parks are usually acres. They contain full playgrounds, parking lots, facilities. And they're to be shared and used by the entire community. Neighborhood parks, they look at radiuses. Now, how what families are served or people are served in a certain mile radius of the neighborhood park. And if you are developing a community and you get too far from a neighborhood park, then you start looking at maybe this is something we need to consider because it would be too far for these kids to walk to any of the existing parks. And so that's what they consider when they grow communities is where's the best placement of parks so the most people can use it and can walk to it safely.
Mm-hmm.
And then community parks are more the idea that you would have a parking lot. You perhaps would drive there. They're of greater acreage. There may be multiple playgrounds. And maybe there's something special there like tennis courts, basketball courts, volleyball courts. It just sort of depends on what fits.
Is the skateboard area, is that a city park?
Yep, that's a specialty park like the dog park in South Ames, which is a newer park. The skate park and the dog park are both unique in that they are they were driven by users and that users helped fund those. So there were skateboarding groups that really wanted a skate park in Ames, and they raised money to bring it. And there was the Friends of the Ames Dog Park that raised money to bring a dog park to Ames. So those are really great examples of private-public partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably aware at Roosevelt Park. That's the park that is right next to the recently renovated Roosevelt School. The neighbors in that area are trying to raise funds to upgrade the park. So there's a plan and there's a budget. And sometimes people want something a little bit more and more exciting. And so the neighbors are trying to raise money to maybe upgrade the playground equipment or the layout or the landscaping. I'm not quite sure exactly what their plan is, but they are in the middle of a fundraising campaign right now to improve that park.
Mm-hmm. Now, Roosevelt Park, that's what's recently been changed into the building into apartments, right?
Right. So the building is privately owned.
Right.
And then I think it's an acre and a half next to it mm-hmm. was given to the city, and now the city's developing that into a park. And there are plans available on our website. If you go to amesparkrec.org, you can see the plans for the Roosevelt Park. And Roosevelt Park is known for having music on Sundays.
Right.
And so part of the park design includes a place to have music.
A stage of some sort,
some playground equipment, and then some really nice landscaping and trails.
Nice. So just going back to connect with the exhibit about parks that have names, how is it decided whether a park should be named for a person or just given another name like the Roosevelt Park or something? Well, I guess that is a person, but not a local person.
Well, I think parks, cities in general are happy to do, to receive bequests. And as part of certain bequests, I think as it's gone back in time, if you bequest to the city often, you get to name the park.
And some really good examples of that, which are featured in the exhibit, are Moore Memorial Park.
There's two Moore parks in it.
Yep,
a little one near where I live.
And those two families aren't related, but both of them are featured in our exhibit.
Okay.
But Moore Memorial Park was a farm that was given to the city to make a park. And Inis Grove is another good example of that.
Okay. Well, I think we'll wrap it up with that and just remind the listener that if they want to see the time capsule, it will be at the Historical Society until the end of April. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
And then it will be moved over to the library.
Yes.
And then they can come back in 50 years when it's open.
Yep.
If it's still alive.
To see how life has changed. Well, thank you both for being here today. We've been talking with Casey Vance, the Executive Director of the Ames Historical Society, and Susan Guiazda, the Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames. And thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That's 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We'd like to thank all of our in-studio and pre-recorded guests. Thanks to Rachel Williams from the University of Iowa and to Casey Vance and Susan Guiazda, who joined us in the studio.
Thank you as well to Sierra Stevens from the Mid-Iowa Community Action. Local Talk was engineered by Rick Morrison. Our theme song is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from the CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show.
If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 282-292-2878 or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to the show and all our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org.
And remember, our fun drive starts on Friday and runs for 10 days. During that time, we'll have lots of live programming with interesting guests. So remember to listen, donate, and if you want to be a part of the fun drive, you can. Just volunteer to help. Call us at 292-2878 or drop by the station in downtown Ames and you can be a part of it. Your hosts for Local Talk today were Gail Seiler and Kay Puttock. Remember that you, as a listener, are the most important part of KHOI. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.